Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Good.
All right. This is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference for the 22nd of February, 2017. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis facilitating, and Craig McKee, Secretary. We will now proceed with a roll call. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, I've just got seven names on here, so I'm sure I'm missing some. But I have Barton Bruce, Cheryl Curtis, Ken Freeland, myself, Kat McGuire, Lynn Bradbury, and Chuck Smith.
Bill Wilt.
Bill Wilt, great.
Jim Tupper.
James.
And John O'Malley.
I got Barry. What was the other one?
John O'Malley.
John O'Malley, okay, great.
Greg Longo.
Greg Longo, okay.
Nita, did you get Nita? Is
on
oh,
no,
roster?
I didn't. No, got you.
I don't think you've got me on there.
And Peter, that's you, Peter?
Yeah,
Peter Ketchum. Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Yes, got you now.
And then we still have a wireless caller with the 857. If you can identify yourself, that would be great. Otherwise, I guess, should I delete them?
That is a Verizon cell number, apparently. I just looked it up as an NPANXX lookup.
Okay.
But what was the last four digits I can try for a person?
0796.
Okay, let's see what I get.
Craig, I'm here too, Sheila Casey.
Okay, great. Hi, Sheila.
Hi.
So, shall I read this back in, or?
Yeah, I guess. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have Barton Bruce, Cheryl Curtis, Ken Freeland, myself, Kat McGuire, James Hufford, Barry Zwicker, John O'Malley, Sheila Casey, Peter Ketchum, Nita Renfrew, Gary Longo, Bill Wilt, Chuck Smith, and Lynn Bradbury. Got everybody?
Anybody not mentioned on the call? All right, then. Well, let's move ahead to our minutes approval. Any objections to approving the minutes as circulated by Craig this month? Hearing none, then the minutes are approved, and we'll move on to tonight's agenda. Any objections to using the draft agenda as written, or is there a need for amendment? Hearing none, then we'll move forward with tonight's program. Our first guest of honor tonight is Doug Valentine, and Cheryl made the original move to involve Doug in our call tonight. She'll give our formal introduction. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, so Douglas Valentine is an American journalist and author of the book The Hotel Tacloban, The Phoenix Program, The Strength of the Wolf, which was the winner of the Choice Academic Library Award, and he's also written The Strength of the Pack. His articles have appeared regularly in Counterpunch, Consortium News, and elsewhere. Portions of his research materials are archived at the National Security Archive, Texas Tech University's Vietnam Center, and John Jay College. And he's here tonight to talk to us about his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. So, Doug, please welcome to the show, and the mic is yours.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. How is the can you hear me well enough?
Yeah, a little audio, a little more volume would be good, Doug, if you have it, but if not, we can hear you okay.
How's that?
About it, better if, it would be better if you were off conference call. I think you might be on that.
Oh, well, should I put it in mute mode? And
it's no, not I mean, gonna. Yeah, you should put it in a lecture mode, Cheryl.
I think he's on a speakerphone. I think that's why he sounds so remote.
That's what I mean. Okay. Speakerphone. Yeah, sorry, misspoke.
Well, he's got to do what he's got to do. Okay, he's only got limited options. So,
but it sounds as though he's some distance from the microphone.
Yeah.
Can you turn me up at your end?
Not really. No. But that's okay. We can hear you. We can hear you, and we're going to mute all the other microphones, so we'll be able to hear you okay, Doug. It's okay. All right?
Okay. Now,
okay, I'll give it a go, and just let me know at some point if it's not working out so that I don't keep talking, and if it's not working out.
Fair enough.
I very much appreciate you having me, giving me an opportunity to talk about my book. As you know, the title is The CIA is Organized Crime, and how these illegal operations corrupt America and the world. The book itself is a compilation of interviews that I've done in the last 15 years and a lot of articles that I wrote over the last 15 years. And my publisher, Diana Collier, was bugging me for years to put them all together in a book, and I didn't want to do it. So eventually she went out and got a bunch of the interviews and articles together and just presented them to me and asked me to update them. So I updated them. Some of them were 15 years old. So I tried to make everything. I went back over them, these interviews and articles, and I tried to update them and make them relevant. Some of them were pretty new, and it didn't take a lot of updating, but that's how the book was put together. The book itself is composed of four parts. The first part is about the CIA's Phoenix program and how the Phoenix program is the model for how the United States creates and fights the war on terror. I'll tell you more about that in a bit. The second part is about the CIA's role in international drug trafficking and its relationship with the DEA, how it controls the DEA and all other federal agencies, and even a couple of foreign agencies in foreign governments, their narcotic bureaus and things like that, and how the CIA has been able to infiltrate them and to control them. The third part is how the Phoenix program, which was created back in 1960s,
please continue.
The Phoenix program is the model for the Department of Homeland Security and how, because it's a CIA program and it was used for pacifying foreign societies, how over the last 40 years, the people who created the Phoenix program, starting with 9/11, we're able to apply it here at home for the same general purposes that it was used overseas. So that whole third section, which I'll also talk a little bit more about, is devoted to how the Phoenix program came home to roost as the Department of Homeland Security. And then the fourth part is about the CIA's relationship with the media. And I can't overstate how important language is in the Phoenix program and all the systems of control, which are government and the rulers of the establishment and the rulers, industrial and wealthy elite, how important language is in controlling us and shaping our assumptions and the things that we believe and getting us to respond in certain ways. And that so the fourth part is about how the CIA has been able to infiltrate and control the media the same way that it does the Department of Homeland Security or the Drug Enforcement Administration or any number of other things. So there's those four parts, but the book itself begins with a very kind of short introduction, which is crucial to the book, and explains how I came to gather all this information that I talk about in the book, and how I got access to the CIA in order to see it from the inside out, because the information I got and this knowledge that I have was based primarily on interviews that I did with CIA officers, and not just CIA officers, but CIA officers who actually infiltrated the DEA. And, of course, I interviewed hundreds of DEA officers and agents, and it was that extraordinary access that I had that enabled me to see things from the inside out, which is so that introductory section explains that, and it basically has to do with how I formed a relationship with a guy named William Colby. Colby was a senior CIA officer. He'd been a he was in the OSS in World War II, and when I finished that first book that you mentioned, The Hotel Top Globe, and I wanted to write a book about the Vietnam War, I wanted to write a book about a part of the Vietnam War that nobody had written about before, and I found out that this guy, William Colby, had run the Phoenix program for a couple of years in Vietnam. He'd been crucial and instrumental in creating it and running it, and he had testified defended the Phoenix program before Congress in 1971, 72, and in 1973 during the hearings when he was nominated to become the director of Central Intelligence, which he did become. And he was, Colby was the director of Central Intelligence from 1973 until the end of 75. Anyway, that introduction explains why I was able to form a relationship with Colby. And why Colby then, when I told him I wanted to write a book about Phoenix, why he started introducing me to very, very high-level CIA officers, people who had been involved in creating and running Phoenix, but were also involved at very high senior executive management level of the programs that Phoenix coordinated. He introduced me to a guy named Evan Parker, for example, who had been in the OSS with him. Colby and this guy Parker had been in the OSS together, and when Colby created the Phoenix program, he put this guy Parker in charge of it. And when he decided to help me, he sent me to this guy Parker. And Parker actually gave me a copy of the roster of the original Phoenix Directorate, and so that led me to even more people. And through Colby, I was able to interview a guy named Muldoon, John Muldoon, who had actually run the CIA's interrogation program in South Vietnam. The CIA built an interrogation center in every province in South Vietnam starting in 1965, and those interrogation centers were run jointly by the CIA and the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. So I got to understand exactly how that interrogation center system was set up. He introduced me to a guy named Tom Donahue, who ran all the CIA's covert action programs in South Vietnam. So I got to understand how covert action programs are set up, and I got that it was explained to me by the senior executive who did it. So I got a PhD course in how the CIA is organized and how it operates. And those interviews with these very senior people who then introduced me to their subordinates and the people that actually carried out their programs, and I interviewed all of them, and I interviewed everybody from the top of the program down to the bottom, to soldiers, sergeants and lieutenants and captains who actually served in the Phoenix program. So through all these interviews, I got to understand the program in a way that nobody had ever understood it before. I actually understood it better than any particular CIA officer himself, because they were just in one compartment of it. And after 4 years, I understood all the compartments, and I was able to put it together in a way that was very made the CIA very nervous. to put it mildly, at first they thought it was a great. Kobe thought it was going to be a great thing, but by the time I got halfway through this, my research, the CIA was already starting to spy on me, and I actually ended up filing a Freedom of Information Act, Privacy Act request, and got the documents that the file that they compiled on me while I was doing the research, and in it they said I had acquired enough information to damage the CIA. And what they thought, they originally thought that I was going to write a book that was going to present them as heroes, and of course I ended up writing a book that was very critical, but the whole first section of the book, which is about Phoenix and what it did in South Vietnam and how the CIA set it up, relies largely on these interviews, and it takes the knowledge I have about the Phoenix program, and it shows how Phoenix as a system was adopted by the CIA as the model for the way that it would conduct counterinsurgency operations around the world and counterterror operations around the world. And I track in that first section how the CIA officers who set up Phoenix in South Vietnam actually pop up in El Salvador and Nicaragua, the same exact people, and they actually use the same methods in Central America during Iran-Contra based on the Phoenix program to run pacification and counterinsurgencies in Central America. And then naturally, after 9/11, they transport the same Phoenix program to Afghanistan and then Iraq. And, of course, they use it to conduct it's the basis for how the United States conducts the war on terror around the world. So this summary, I can't get into all the details. If you want to know the details, they're there. But in a very general sense, Phoenix can be understood as a system that's a highly bureaucratized system that's designed to expel anybody or anything that can't be ideologically assimilated. And it's this idea of a systems, and Phoenix is a system. And, of course, language has a lot to do with it, but it's this idea of Phoenix as a system that's absolutely integral to the book. And I begin the book with a quote from a guy named Johann Galtung, and he says, personal violence is for the amateur in dominance. Structural violence is the tool of the professional. The amateur who wants to dominate uses guns. The professional uses social structures. And you can see this in the evolution, and I talk about this in the book, as we evolve from, the American Revolution, where the United States was actually a slave state, and we evolved through the Civil War and the industrialization of the United States, and then after World War II, the United States as the single world power, and the United States becoming a highly technocratic society. How the systems evolve, and they adapt, but the same social structures stay in place, and you go from slavery to segregation, you go to Jim Crow laws, tax laws are put in place, tax systems that are put in place so that a person like me, a slob like me, pays more in taxes than Donald Trump. And corporations pay no taxes. So it's important to understand in our modern society how systems dominate us. and how the Phoenix program, and I try to explain it as one of these systems, but because it's a CIA system, it's a secret system. And it's very hard to understand it. You can't understand a system like Phoenix the way you can go read the tax laws or the way Jim Crow laws or segregation are in your face. So they're a little bit, it's part of the security apparatus, Phoenix, that a lot of people might think of as the deep state. It's these secret systems that aren't apparent that actually are the way that our rulers dominate us. And that's all part of that first section of the book. The second section of the book is about how the CIA actually commandeered drug law enforcement in the United States. And not only did I interview a lot of CIA officers about this, who are part of this commandeering of drug law enforcement in the United States, but I talked to hundreds of DEA agents who told me how the CIA was actually commandeering the DEA from their perspective. It's important to know that this process of the CIA taking over federal drug law enforcement began at exactly the same time the Phoenix program began in South Vietnam. The Phoenix program kicks in South Vietnam in 1967 and 1968. And at that time, in the United States, the federal drug law enforcement was under an agency called the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And up until 1967, it only had 16 agents overseas. One of them was in Bangkok, and he uncovered evidence, of course, as did a couple of other agents who were passing through the region, that the CIA was running the narcotic business in the Golden Triangle. Al McCoy talks about it in his book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. And as the United States was building up its presence in South Vietnam, it became evident that the CIA was running the Golden Triangle drug trade out of Laos, Burma, and Thailand. And the CIA had to protect that drug trafficking network that it had set up out there. And so an entirely new, the Bureau of Narcotics was disbanded and reformed within the Justice Department. It had been in the Treasury Department, and it was reformed in the Department of Justice. And CIA officers took over its foreign operations. They actually put CIA officers in place into the intelligence office of the Bureau of Narcotics of Dangerous Drugs, which was this new organization. And the CIA took over all the foreign operations, and you went from having 16 federal narcotic agents overseas to having hundreds and hundreds of them overseas. And their purpose after 1968, and as the CIA solidified its control over the DEA, which was formed in 1973, was basically as an adjunct of the security system that the CIA was setting up, along with Congress and the executive branch of the government, to protect the CIA and so that it can continue to function as the manager of the world's narcotic business. And the DEA, I show step by step how the DEA basically was taken over by the CIA and its intelligence division, its executive management division. I approach it very bureaucratically and show how the DEA is basically just nowadays an adjunct of the CIA. And of course, all this, when you get updated, it ends up in Afghanistan, which in the year 2000, after the Taliban took over, provided about 10% of the world's heroin. After the CIA took over Afghanistan in 2001, the DEA sent about 600 agents out there. They never made a narcotic case in the last 15 years. And Afghanistan under CIA rule now provides 90% of the heroin to the world, and it has for the last 15 years. This is well known. And the reason, of course, is that when the CIA and the United States government decided to take over Afghanistan, the only way it could dominate that country was by enlisting as its main allies the drug warlords who ran the country. And I give all the names, and I spell it all out exactly how it happened in this book. And it's part of the idea that the CIA is a corrupting influence. In the same way that the Phoenix program could only succeed in a foreign country by corrupting the security officers that the CIA deals with in those countries, and I explain how that happens, the CIA can only control a country like Iraq, or in this particular case Afghanistan, by hiring corrupted officials, by individuals like these warlords. And that corruption, as one DEA agent explained it to me, if you can lie, steal, and cheat, and that's what makes you successful in your work, which is what the CIA and the DEA do, then those things, lying, stealing, and cheating, become the things that you use in the organization that you work with, that you work within. Those become the principles and the ethic. And if you look around and you see our country, especially now with Trump as president, you can see how it's just utterly corrupted, and how especially words mean nothing anymore. And all that matters is domination and being able to manipulate systems so that this particular ideology that we're now subjected to can expel anybody from the system that it doesn't like. The third part of my book, which is about the Department of Homeland Security and the whole Homeland Security boondoggle that was put in place after 9/11, explains in a very organizational and bureaucratic ways how this whole Phoenix system of corruption and political and social control, having proved that it was so effective overseas in dominating foreign countries, in conquering foreign countries, in colonizing foreign countries, always so that American businesses could move in and turn the people there into cheap labor and producers of commodities, that actually the whole Department of Homeland Security is actually modeled on the Phoenix program the way it is applied overseas. And that the basis of the Phoenix program was a system of centers that were set up around South Vietnam. There was a Phoenix center set up in every province, just like there was an interrogation set up in every province. It was called the Province Intelligence and Operations Coordinating Center, an IOC, Intelligence Operations Coordinating Center. And not only did the CIA set up one in every province, which was like a state, there were 44 provinces, and they were like the states in South Vietnam, it set one up in every district. And that was a DIOC, a District Intelligence Operations and Coordinating Center. And they brought together these IOCs, whether they were at the province or district level, they brought together every agency in that area that was involved in collecting intelligence on the citizens that lived in that area. They could target all those citizens through every agency that conducted any kind of law enforcement, police, intelligence, or military, or even civic organizations. It could coordinate them all out of a center to go after those people that it was wishing to expel from the system. And in the Department of Homeland Security is set up exactly that way through what is called fusion centers, which I can talk to you about more if you have some questions about them. But the Department of Homeland Security has set up a fusion center in every state that functions exactly like the Phoenix Intelligence and Operations and Coordinating Centers did in South Vietnam. And it, of course, it's much more complicated, but just like CIA officers infiltrated the DEA, based on these interviews I did, I show how veterans of the Phoenix program and the CIA actually became individuals who I did interviews with, one of whom was a guy named Rob Simmons, who was a CIA officer in South Vietnam, how he actually became a congressman and was instrumental in establishing the Department of Homeland Security, and another CIA officer named Bruce Lawler, who I interviewed at length, actually became the first chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security. And there are these kind of Phoenix veterans in all of our domestic law enforcement management positions all throughout the system. And, of course, the fourth section of my book deals with the CIA's relationship with the media. I'm sure a lot of you probably have a very good idea of how that works. On how it started with Operation Mockingbird back in the 1950s when the CIA actually hired a lot of journalists and established relationships with with Hollywood and with producers and with the owners of publishing companies, publishers, all the senior editors, and how over the last 50, 60 years, those relationships have become so incestuous that you can't tell the difference anymore between the senior level management of the CIA and the ownership of the media, the five or six corporations that basically own all the media in the United States, whether it's Fox preaching its line or MSNBC preaching its line, the CIA is there in its office making sure that none of these corporate media, private media organizations are spilling any of the secrets. And whether it's Fox or MSNBC, they do not spill any of the secrets about this, for lack of a better word, Phoenix coordinating system that's secret and it's not something that you can see and you can only learn about by actually reading a book like the one I wrote, because even people like Tim Weiner, or Weiner, or whatever his name is, who's like this New York Times guy who writes books that are supposedly exposés about the CIA, he doesn't get into any of it. And everybody who's like a spokesperson for the CIA or the establishment is always dancing around these essential secret systems that have been put in place and how they've been put in place and they control to such a great degree the information that we receive that a guy like Donald Trump can be elected, or even a person like Hillary Clinton can get close to being elected, because they control so much of the information that we receive that our very basic assumptions, our knowledge and understanding of the world is inadequate to the task of being able to govern ourselves and to resist these systems that are in place and have been evolving, believe me, since 1775. So anyway, it's hard to sum up a subject that's so broad at one end of the spectrum and so it has so much detail that you need to understand at the other end of the spectrum. But that's what I try to do. I try to show how the stated policies are contradicted by the actual operational realities that we're experiencing every day. So anyway, my throat is dry, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Well, great. Thank you so much for that. That really comprehensive overview of your book. We are now going to go into question and answer mode. If you want to ask a question of Doug, press *6 and you'll be put into the queue to ask a question. But I need to let everybody know that Doug has a hearing difficulty. He's partly dependent on captions for understanding what you're saying. So your questions need to be short, direct, to the point, and very slowly stated so that he can capture what it is that you're asking him. In the meantime, I'm going to ask the first question here on behalf of one of our regular callers who couldn't be here tonight. And he asked me to ask you this question. Are you familiar with the work of Gary Webb and his claim that DynCorp is fashioning various Phoenix programs for implementation here and abroad?
DynCorp is that sort of like a mercenary construction company, right, that provides, that actually does construction for military bases and provides security for military bases. Is that the DynCorp we're talking about?
Yeah, DynCorp.
Yeah. I didn't know that Gary Webb had talked about it at all. Was it Gary Webb?
It's either Gary Webb or George Webb. I can't remember the first guy's first name. I don't have the email in front of me.
They're absolutely they're a perfect symbol, you know, of the relationship, the absolutely essential relationship between private corporations and government, and understanding that to a very great extent, that's what America is. You know, I mean, it's freewheeling capitalism, and the people that created the CIA were privateers, people that had business interests overseas, and they were the people that were integrated into the OSS and actually initially were running the CIA. And it is that you can't understand what this kind of systems are that without understanding that evolution. And DynCorp is a perfect symbol of it. If you're going to have an empire, which of course the United States is, and you need symbiotic relationship between corporations like DynCorp, which do basically the work of colonizing foreign countries. And if you look at the ownership of DynCorp and its management, it's basically recycling former generals, former CIA officers, and when guys finish a career in the CIA or the military, they go into a corporation like DynCorp. And what's been happening, you know, where they apply all their skills to colonizing foreign countries, to building military established bases on them, to corrupting foreign officials and foreign businessmen and getting them to follow American policies that are diametrically opposed to the needs of the people in those countries. And all those people, the DynCorp people, are creating similar kind of corporations here in the United States as income inequality the gap gets larger, and there's more and more very rich people and excuse me, fewer and fewer very rich people and more very poor people, there's just this tremendous need for increased law enforcement here in the United States in order to really control society. And we see it happening. We see it happening before our very eyes right now as Trump hires 15,000 extra ICE agents so they can expel from the United States millions of illegal immigrants. And guess what, folks? Those 15,000 ICE agents aren't going to be going away after all the immigrants are expelled. The police forces are being beefed up on it was incrementally over the last 15 years, but now it's becoming an avalanche. And when we wake up from this, we're going to find that, you know, the rich political elite has colonized us here in the United States as well. And it's happening through corporations like DynCorp. Okay. And the relationship they have with the government, and especially its security services.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Doug. Okay, Cheryl, you want to take the next question?
Yes, it's Bill Wills.
Hi, this is Bill. Mr. Valentine, had you been aware that in the 1999 case, King v. Jowers, over the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., that in some testimony there was adduced that said the Phoenix program, the government set up six Phoenix sites throughout the continental United States, plus one more in Washington, D.C., whose job was to neutralize Vietnam veterans, folk singers, prominent people who were against the Vietnam War. Were you aware of that?
Well, actually, I testified at the King versus Jowers trial. I worked as an investigator for Bill Pepper. Bill Pepper hired me as an investigator, and based on the fact that in the Phoenix Program book, I talked about an interview I did with a sergeant who was in military intelligence in South Vietnam and was part of the Phoenix Program there. And when he came back to the United States in 1968, he was working in one of the, there were about six or seven military intelligence groups in the United States at that time in 1968. The military was allowed to spy on American civilians, and they had military intelligence groups around the country. And this guy, whose name was Ed, had been in the Phoenix program, and he came back to the United States, and he was in Washington, D.C., in a military intelligence group there. Their job was to create provocations in demonstrations so that the cops could come in and bust heads and stuff like that. He was in touch with people from a military intelligence group in Memphis.
Wow.
And they told him, and he told me, that the day that King was assassinated, that military intelligence unit in Memphis actually had King under surveillance, and that they had actually taken photographs of the assassination. And I wrote that in the Phoenix Program book, and on that basis, William Pepper, who was the King's attorney, hired me as an investigator, and he sent me down to Memphis. And I went down to Memphis, and I interviewed a guy who was head of the fire department. There was, if you've ever been to Memphis and you see where the Lorraine Motel was, it's at the bottom of a hill, and on top of the hill is a fire station.
Right.
And I talked to the guy who was the fire chief, and he told me that on the day of the assassination, two military intelligence guys came to the firehouse and asked them if they could go up on the roof of the firehouse. And I testified about that at the trial. the King versus Jowers trial.
Has
and that
anyone
testimony
got,
was one of the reasons that the jury found that the government was actually involved in the King assassination. Okay, so
right.
So yeah, I'm aware of all that, and I didn't actually write about it in this new book, but I have written about it elsewhere, and one of the articles is called. Well, if you just send me an email, I'll send you the articles I wrote about it, but they're pretty widely publicized. So, yeah, I know about that.
I guess so. Okay.
Thank you, Bill. We're running short on time, so we have to ask again that you keep your questions very short. And if in response to any questions, Doug, please, if you would, limit keep your answers really brief, okay? Thank you. Okay, next question, please.
Okay. Barry?
Hi, this is Barton.
Sorry, it's Barton. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the computer told me it was me, so I guess it's my turn. It said there's a thing called Black Eagle Trust, which I believe was a lot of CIA people collecting gold from Japanese who'd stolen it from the Chinese, but maybe other things. But there's this so-called trust fund, which funded all kinds of things, probably also Iran-Contra stuff. But all this drug money, does that tie into that too? And the Black Eagle Trust money, I think, also spawned some new Wall Street area banks with the senior staff being former CIA people. How does all that fit into the bigger picture of things? I'm sort of priming with a question. I just don't know where that would lead.
Okay.
It does all fit together. And, again, that's why the book is called The CIA's Organized Crime. The CIA controls drug trafficking around the world, but it also controls arms trafficking around the world. And wherever you have arms going into a country, you know, like Mexico, the United States sends lots of arms and guns into Mexico, and it brings a lot of cocaine out. And the CIA controls that whole apparatus all around the world. It's in control of all the major arms manufacturers and drug producers and drug gangs. But it also needs a banking system where it can launder all this dirty money. So those three things, banking, drugs, and arms, are basically the sort of the trinity of the CIA's underworld empire. And it has banks set up all around the world where it can launder all this drug and arms money, all the profits it makes from these trades, and that's the money it uses to bribe politicians and secret services and policemen and customs agents and businessmen all around the world. Those three businesses, arms, drugs, and banking, are the basis of the CIA's underworld empire, and it's through those three things that it corrupts the entire world, and all that corruption has come back home to the United States. Everything that's happening overseas is also happening here now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, next one. Is there
okay.
Any more, Cheryl?
Next is Barry Zwicker.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, Barry Zwicker here in Toronto. This is a terrific book. I'm going to get a copy of it, absolutely, for sure. It's right up there with Marchetti and Marx and Stockwell and so forth. I have a whole lot of questions, so I'll just ask two. First one is about Gina Haspel. And I bet that you know the name, but for those who may not, she's just been appointed by Trump to a senior position in his administration. And she's the person who was in charge of torture in Thailand. I learned this from a friend first. From a friend who lives in Thailand and is very well informed and is a member of the Bertrand Russell Society listserv that I'm on. And so that's one thing, is to ask what you know about or think about Trump appointing her. My second question is, do you have any information about CIA operations in Canada, past or ongoing.
Well, yeah, I like you, I can't remember her name right now, but I do. I'm very familiar with the fact that she ran that black site in Thailand, and that she was actually responsible for the interrogation of some very important high-value targets, and oversaw waterboarding and all sorts of, like, barbaric practices. But what she is, what this woman, it's more important what she represents than who she is individually. She's a symbol. And you have to understand that in terms of these, what I was talking about, the importance of language. And I talk a lot about symbolism in this book. And this woman, the way you're reacting to her is exactly the reaction that you're supposed to have. This is, you're supposed to fear this woman. Trump put her in position, nominated her to be a deputy director of the CIA exactly because she symbolizes this new policy that Trump is going to be imposing, which is everything goes. We're going to, it's really, it's designed to terrify you. And so don't react to the symbolism of this appointment. That's the way you're supposed to react. And read my book and you'll understand more about it and how the details of how this and the importance of black sites and interrogations and stuff like that, it'll help to assuage some of your concerns about what's going on and help you to deal with it in a more appropriate fashion rather than worrying about it, okay?
Okay.
It doesn't do any good to worry about it. The other thing is that the CIA is all over Canada, and it's instrumentally involved with all organized crime in Canada. It's one of the main bases for the CIA, because while everybody's focused on Mexico and the idea that all sorts of, you know, we need a wall to protect us from the Mexicans, there's actually a whole lot of arms and drugs trafficking going on across the Canadian border too, and CIA has just done a much better job of disguising its operations there. But Canada's no different than any other country in the world. They've all been assimilated into the American Empire. They're all part of the system, and they're integral to what's going on. So,
okay, thank you.
Understand it from the point of view of the big picture.
Okay.
Good.
Anybody else here?
Yeah, we have two more. The next one is Lynn Bradbury.
Hi, this is Lynn. Thanks for being here. I just wonder if you put Philip Aggie, I'm not sure his name, inside the company in the fake whistleblower category.
Well, Aggie is one of my heroes.
Okay,
and
good.
If you read his books, you'll really go a long way towards understanding the CIA. But I would certainly put him in a much higher class than merely whistleblower.
Okay, that's good to know. Thanks.
You know, I mean, he's beyond whistleblower.
I think we have one more question.
We have two more, actually.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. Perfect.
Thank you.
It's Craig. I'd like to ask one, too, if I can.
Okay, can you wait? Okay, I'll get you last,
okay.
Craig. Okay.
Yeah.
Next is Kat McGuire.
Okay. Hi, this is Kat McGuire, and I'm reading Doug's book right now. It's over the top, spectacular, really superb. Everyone must read it. My question for you, Doug, is based on Oded Yinon and Clean Break and the Israeli first or neocons, why is it that I'm seeing almost zero mention of Mossad and Israel and the Zionists in your books. We know they're directly connected with running programs all over the world in conjunction with the U.S., and yet you barely mention them. Could you please talk about Israeli Zionists?
Yeah, that's a, you know, there's, that probably is a deficiency in my book. And I'm a great supporter of the Palestinians. I edited a poetry book called With Our Eyes Wide Open and made sure that if you like poetry, folks, go out and read it. And made sure that there was a lot of poetry that refers exactly to that situation. But you're right. The Zionists, their influence in the United States, especially in the realm of information management and banking, in the arms and drug trade, is central to these things. And of course, the way that the Zionists have organized Israel is the model for how people like Trump want to organize the United States, and there's no accident that Netanyahu is so much in love with Trump. I mean, these are people who are ideologically on the same line, just like the Israelis, the Zionists, colonized that part of the world, and they did so in the most brutal fashion, and they put all the systems in place that are like Phoenix program systems, and those systems that the Zionists put in place in Israel are basically models for the Phoenix program itself. So by studying the Zionists, you can understand exactly what our rulers have in store for us here in the United States. And,
okay.
And it is a deficiency in my book, but unfortunately I couldn't talk about everything. But right.
Okay.
Study them and learn them, and you're right on track.
Thanks, Doug. Who else, Cheryl?
Okay, next is Gregory Longo.
This is Greg. Unfortunately, I had the same question Kat had.
Okay, well, thanks. I guess that's been answered, so appreciate that. Can we move on and let Craig speak then?
Sure.
And
next is
Doug,
Greg.
Because Doug needs to take off, okay?
Okay, very quick question. To what extent do you feel that Hollywood movies and television currently are controlled by the CIA or other kind of related entities, and how do you think that works?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and I think it gets exactly to the heart of what everything is that I'm trying to explain, and I think that the control is almost total. I think that from what I see, and I'm an avid TV watcher, I watch it all and study it, and the same with movies and cable. I absolutely, and I talk about it in the book, I'm absolutely convinced. And it's not just the CIA. It's what the CIA represents as the security systems that control our information. They control it through secrecy, by things that you're not allowed to know. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking and quoting about a guy named Guy Debord, who wrote a book called Society of the Spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1967, mm-hmm. And just in terms of your question about Hollywood and what we see, Guy Debord said, secrecy dominates our world, and foremost as the secret of domination. We can't see how the CIA and the security systems influence TV and Hollywood. But it's there, and it has to be mapped out, and it's the obligation of all of us, not just to sit here and watch these programs, which are interrupted every 30 seconds telling us to buy a commodity, something that we don't need, and how the substance of these TV shows and movies really is designed to make us so compliant and to put us in the right state of mind that we actually feel we need these commodities. And that's what the essence of Hollywood and TV is. I mean, it's TV was created not to give you entertainment or information, but to sell you shit you don't need.
Okay. Well, thank you, Doug.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry we kept you so long tonight, but I think everybody benefited from the opportunity to have an interchange with you. So thank you so much for spending time with us tonight. I'm sure that everybody, including myself, is going to run out and get your book because you've certainly whetted our appetite for it. So thank you once again for the opportunity.
Thanks
to
very much. It's an honor to be able to speak mm-hmm. to people who are interested in these things.
Okay, so with that wonderful first act, we move on now to our second part of the agenda, and that would be Craig's presentation on Lloyd Inn. Go ahead, Craig.
Oh, okay. I thought that, am I muted?
No.
Hold on.
No, you're
am
okay.
I unmuted?
We hear you. We hear you.
Oh, okay. All right. I was expecting that I was the third item on the agenda, so you threw me a curve. Okay. Does everybody have my PowerPoint presentation open? It's there's a link to it in the draft agenda. So if you can have a look at that, that will make things more clear. So I'll start here. In this presentation, I'm going to address the absence of any credible evidence that Lloyd England's cab was hit by any light pole at the Pentagon on 9/11. Let's see here. Now, if for those of you with the PowerPoint open, you'll see on slide number 2 a picture of Lloyd England and the cab that he was driving on 9/11. Now, England's story is a key element of the Pentagon official story. If it is shown to be true, then the story gets a major boost. If it does not stand up to scrutiny, then the official story suffers a major blow. And just to go back, it's the reason that it gets a major boost if it is shown to be true is because it means that the plane really did fly on the official flight path and it really did knock down light poles as the official story contends. And of course, I don't believe that that's the case. So let's go to slide number 5. Now, England tells us that the long piece of the pole, and you'll see this in a photograph in a moment, which is more than 20 feet long, is what hit his car after being knocked off its moorings, the pole knocked off its moorings by the plane. He claims it penetrated his windshield, lodging in the back seat. He says he and a silent stranger stood in front of the car's hood and pulled the pole out. As you'll see on the next slide, just coming up, his car came to a stop nearly perpendicular to the direction of the road. So the pole sticking out of the windshield would have been pointing towards the side of the road. England claims he flagged down a stranger who he referred to as a friend in his 2006 interview with CIT, and later as a stranger who didn't say a word and was, in quotes, so quiet. The two supposedly pulled the pole out over the hood, but it can be seen lying in the road parallel to the side of the road. So they would not only have had to pull it out, they would have had to carry it several feet and turn it so that it faced a completely different direction. England says he fell with the pole on top of him, but the stranger did not come to his aid. Did he fall under the pole before it was moved to its final location? Then how was it moved without the help of the other man? Did he fall under it after it was moved? In that case, why wouldn't the man help him at this point? Now, slide 6, you can see a picture of Lloyd's cab stopped on the highway, and you can see the damage to the windshield. England says he was traveling 40 miles per hour when the pole hit, and he had to struggle to to regain control of the car and to stop. Through all of this, the pole was supposedly wedged into the back seat and resting on the dashboard. But a photo, which is not included here, but a photo taken by Craig Ranke of CIT in 2008 of the inside of the cab showed that the dash was below the lip of the hood. So anything resting on the dash should also have been resting on the hood. And yet there is no dent or even scratch on the hood. Now, we go to slide 7. Here you can see that the cab is in behind this white car. You can also see a scratch that goes across the road that appears to have been made by the pole being dragged into place. Now, slide 8, you see this is the end of the pole that allegedly lodged in the back seat of the cab. And note the diameter of the end of the pole and also the jagged and protruding metal. Now, the next slide, this you see this is the hole supposedly created by this this bent light pole hurtling through the windshield. One would imagine at very high speed. And you see again at the next slide, slide 10, an even crisper picture. And you can see that there's virtually no damage. I mean, you could barely get your fist into that hole. Just the tiny hole in the back seat is enough to show this story is impossible. Slide 11, why would anyone in the truth movement, I'm asking rhetorically, support the official claim that this rip in the back seat was caused by a flying light pole of any length? Now, no witnesses report seeing anything hit Lloyd's cab. No one says they saw the cab swerving or traveling with a pole sticking out of the windshield. And no one says they saw someone pulling a pole out of the car. In discussions on our teleconference listserv, there have been claims that it is not clear which part of the pole is claimed to have hit Lloyd's cab. This is false. As you'll see on slide 14, England was explicit in stating that it was the long end of the pole, the one attached to the ground, that hit his cab. And there you see a photograph showing that pole that he is alleging penetrated his cab. He stated this repeatedly in on-camera interviews with CIT videos, in CIT videos, Lloyd England and his taxi cab, The Eye of the Storm, and The First Known Accomplice, with a question mark. Now, from that, the latter, here's just a little bit of an exchange here. Lloyd says the lamp was knocked off the pole. The interviewer says, right, here's the lamp. And then, so which piece did you take out of the window? Lloyd says, the long piece. That was from the ground. And there's an unintelligible word, off the ground. That went all the way through the car to the back seat. It was still sticking out across the hood. You took that out by yourself? And he said, yes, I had the help of a friend of mine. And if you just skip to the next slide. So the interviewer says, so it's the long piece. Lloyd says, yeah, the long piece. See, it's the long piece. See the end on it? The interviewer says to someone else in the room, show him the end. And Lloyd says, yeah, this was the piece that was in the ground. Okay, so I think, and he does this in there are other interviews where he is very explicit about it being the long piece, not some piece up at the top. So this means it could not have been pole number 2, as has been suggested. It had to be pole number 1, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Slide 19, you can see the little yellow marks. Those represent each of the 5 light poles that are alleged to have been hit by Flight 77. The one on the right, far right, is pole number 1, and this is the one that is supposed to have been hit first, with the plane's right wing, and pole number 2 is on the same side of the road, but it's the next one down on the other side of this overpass. And on slide 20, you can see where the main part of pole number 2 ended up. It ended up on an embankment beside the road, and also bent at a 90-degree angle. So let's see here now. Slide 21, according to the official story, the alleged plane's right wing knocked pole number 1 straight up the road where it is supposed to have hit Lloyd's cab. And you can see the arrow there pointing to pole number 1, and you can see the angle of the wing. And you know, given that the plane's wings are swept back from perpendicular, the pole should have been knocked to the right and across the road. Also, if it had been knocked in the direction the official story claims, the plane's fuselage would have been directly in the pole's path. Now, England was interviewed twice by CIT, once in 2006 and again in 2008. When he did the second interview, he was aware of the implications of CIT's North of Sitco witness accounts. And despite there being numerous photos showing exactly where his cab was, which was on the overpass and under the official alleged flight path, he now claimed to have been much further north. No matter how much proof he was shown, he maintained in his second interview that he was north of the Sitco gas station, but he clearly was not. Before the on-camera interview with CIT began, Lloyd talked about a neighbor who had taken pictures of the cab. He said he was up on the bridge, which is the overpass right next to light pole number one. But on camera, Lloyd denied being anywhere near the bridge, even as he was shown clear photographic evidence that he was there. He denied it. Now, England has also been inconsistent with other elements of his story. For example, in one interview, he claimed that his wife worked for the FBI. But later, he said she was just a cleaner in the same building where the FBI offices were. Now, Lloyd says, the FBI interviewed me because my wife works for the FBI. They were talking about how they couldn't find me. And she said, well, I see him every day. So once she told them where I was, they were over here in an hour. And then Lloyd says a very odd thing. He says, they assumed I was killed by looking at the car and by looking at the inside. Seems like a surprising thing for the CIA or for the FBI to conclude. So just summing up there, some seem intent on figuring out a way to prop up Lloyd England's story by stating that it must have been the shorter piece that hit his car. There is not a shred of proof to support this. And I want to just mention something that goes into the very interesting and intriguing category, but perhaps isn't proof of anything. But Lloyd made some very interesting comments to CIT. In one part that was recorded, the audio was recorded, he says, one thing you've got to understand, when people do things and get away with it, eventually it's going to come to me. And when it comes to me, it's going to be so big, I can't do nothing about it. So it had to be stopped in the beginning when it's small, you see, to keep it from spreading. And then he says, I'm not supposed to be involved in this. This is for other people, people who have money and all this kind of stuff. And then there's sort of a back and forth where he's saying, you know, this is Craig Ranke says, this is their event. And he says, this is for them. And Craig says, meaning they're doing it for their own reasons. Lloyd says, that's right. I'm not supposed to be in it. Craig says, but they used you, right? Lloyd says, I'm in it. Craig says, you're in it. And Lloyd says, we came across the highway together. And Craig says, you and their event. And Lloyd says, that's right. And Craig says, but they must have planned that. And Lloyd says, it was planned. And then he ends off by saying, you know what history is. History is his story. It's not the truth. It's his story. So I want to finish off. I have got 21 questions about Lloyd England's impossible Pentagon story that I think need to be posed. One, why did Lloyd claim he was nowhere near the bridge on camera, but admit off camera that the neighbor taking close-up photos of the cab and pole was on the bridge? Two, why did he say his wife worked for the FBI and that he couldn't talk about what she did there? And later say she worked as a cleaner in the FBI building. Three, if she was just a cleaner, how would the FBI know her husband was the cab driver whose car was hit by a pole just the day before? Four, why would Lloyd's wife say she knew why the FBI didn't take the taxi in for examination? But that she could not say why. I didn't mention that before, but she did do that. Number five, why would the FBI assume Lloyd was dead after seeing the damage to the interior of his car? Six, how could a car that had just been hit by a more than 20-foot pole swerve around on the road as the driver struggled to regain control without even a scratch being made to the hood? Seven, if the damaged dashboard shown in CIT photos was lower than the edge of the hood, how could the pole rest on the dashboard but not damage the hood? 8, how could a pole of any length smash through the windshield and go through to the back seat without causing significant damage to the seat? 9, how could pole number 1 be knocked forward parallel to the road by the right wing, which was swept back from perpendicular? 10, and how could the pole move in that direction without hitting the plane's fuselage as it crossed the highway, as the plane crossed the highway? 11, why would Lloyd even try to pull the extremely long and heavy pole out of the car in the first place? 12, why did Lloyd refer to the man who helped him as a friend of mine and later as a stranger? 13, why did he refer to the stranger as being so quiet and also describe the scene, again, this is something that wasn't mentioned earlier, but also describe the scene as soon as he got his car stopped as being so quiet? 14, why would Lloyd and the stranger pull the pole out and then swing it around in a completely different direction so that it could be laid on the road parallel to the road? 15, why didn't the stranger help Lloyd when he fell under the pole? 16, why was there a clear scratch across the road that appeared to have been made by the pole being dragged into place? 17, why would anyone claim it was a short piece of pole number 2, as was claimed on our listserv, that hit the cab, when there is not one shred of evidence to support this? 18, how could all of this have happened without it being seen by even one person? 19, why would Lloyd say that this event was for people with money, and why would he suggest that the story we've been told is not the truth? 20, why did Lloyd make such a point of calling into question, as he did in interviews with CIT, whether the hole in the building was large enough for the plane to enter? And finally, why would members of the 9/11 truth movement want to dilute this extremely powerful evidence of staging while supporting the false official flight path and supposed impact? Whenever there is a seemingly irreconcilable hole in the Pentagon official story, we have those who push a plane impact doing all they can to shore up that official story, whether it's a phantom piece of pole number 2 hitting Lloyd's cab or non-existent 757 confetti wreckage near the heliport that we're told is all that remained of the wings and tail section of Flight 77. We keep having the official story propped up in one way or another. I believe it's time that more of us started asking those people why they are focusing on defending key elements of the official story rather than challenging them. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Craig. Okay, I guess it's time for some very quick questions or comments, if anybody has any.
Not too quick, I hope.
Well, it's 8:25, Craig, and we still have another item on the agenda, so... I'm asking people to keep their answers or questions relatively,
right,
you know, succinct. Mm. Okay.
Yep.
So let's see. Cheryl, I guess take the first questioner.
Okay. The first one is Peter Ketchum. Peter, you're ready to go?
Well, okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't really have a question, just a comment. That was an excellent analysis, and I'm really impressed.
Thank you.
Beautifully done and just meticulous, careful, incisive. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, and next is Nita Renfrew.
Hi, this is Sheila Casey. I had a couple of comments to make about this. Craig, yeah, you did an amazing job. The light pole weighed 247 pounds. So try to imagine that would be, if two men are trying to do it, that's the equivalent of each of them lifting a small woman. And Lloyd England is claiming that he fell while he was lifting the light pole out of the cab, out of the windshield, but managed to continue to hold it up over his head so that it didn't scratch the hood. Now, and he's about 65 years old. Imagine a 65-year-old man falling, and even as he's falling, managing to hold 125-pound woman over his head.
without a scratch getting on the hood, which to me is just completely unbelievable. The other thing I want to point out is I actually just sent an email to the listserv with an image that I think should be included, and that's the base of the light poles. The citizen investigation team did a very thorough investigation, and they contacted the man with the in the Virginia Department of Transportation who was really in charge of these light poles. They still had the light poles, and Craig Ranke and Aldo took pictures of the bases of the light poles, the actual light poles that were found there on the road at the Pentagon on 9/11. And what you can see, if you open up the probably the most recent email sent to the listserv tonight, just about 10 minutes ago, that a light pole that's knocked down by other means, such as wind, has a jagged edge. But and here they have just one of the light poles being shown, but you can see the 9/11 pole base looks very neatly done. It really looks like it was cut. It's not at all jagged. And in another really unfortunate turn of events, the young man who allowed them to take pictures of the base of the light poles, who had a good job and a wife and four children, committed suicide about a month after allowing Craig and Aldo to take those pictures of the light poles. And I thought that was a very coincidental suicide myself.
Okay. Good points, all. So, do you need to comment on that, Craig?
You did a good summary of that. I think Lloyd was even older than 65. I think he was closer to 68 or 69. At the time. And one thing I did want to point out that I didn't say in my presentation was, if you look at where all the poles ended up compared to where they were supposedly standing, they're all extremely close to the original location, including light pole number one. Here's the weird part. We're supposed to believe that that particular pole, unlike all the other four, went flying way up the road, more than 150 feet, and went through Lloyd's car, and then Lloyd, trying to get control of his car, ended up basically back where the pole started, right beside where it would have been standing. That, to me, strains credulity quite a lot. So I just thought I would mention that. But, yes, good points, Sheila.
Thank you.
Okay, so...
Okay, did anybody not get a chance to ask a question who might have had technical problems getting in the queue? Okay, just a real quick question, Craig. Is Lloyd England still alive?
As far as I know, he is. I know somebody who...
Has any thought been given to doing a third interview with him?
Yes, I've thought about it. And I know somebody who lives in the area that may even... if not know him, certainly know, you know, where he can be found. So it's a possibility for sure.
Okay, thank you. All right, so that concludes this segment. Thank you so much, Craig, for I think Mr. Ketchum said was a meticulous interview and a meticulous presentation. And let's move on now to our final segment. Bill Wilt is going to brief us very quickly on what's going on college campuses regarding repression of free speech. And then we'll hear from Cheryl on her particular instance. Okay, go ahead, Bill.
Well, I'd like to beg off for a month because I need to call some people. I didn't realize this was going to be a reporting effort.
That's fine. You can do it next month if you prefer.
Okay.
We're running short on time.
Like you to consider just one thing as you go forward through the month is that any promise or word or phrase or whatever is the people seek legal protection from uttering such a thing, expressing such a thing. I've been finding that it's almost ipso facto prima facie evidence of a position or thought that stand on its own, that it needs that defense, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
What I get. Okay.
Fair enough. We'll be inspired by that till we hear your fuller report next month. But we should not close without giving Cheryl an opportunity to brief us on what's been happening with her radio show at University of Hartford. So, Cheryl, can you give us a briefing?
Yeah, I'll try and make it as quick as I can here. So just for people who don't know, I've had a radio program at the University of Hartford where I produced the show since 2008. And in 2010, Wesleyan University took it on their radio station. And things have been fine. And then in 2014, I had Kevin Barrett on my show. And after that, the ADL contacted the University of Hartford president of the university, saying that I had was promoting anti-Semitism, et cetera, on the call, and they wanted my show off the air. So the university president actually likes my show, from what I hear, and so he supported me in this. But they had to kind of appease the ADL, so they made everyone in the whole station had to go to sensitivity training and training in defamation. And guess who taught the sensitivity training? None other than the ADL, and they made $4,000 training us all on that. And so I was told not to do it again or I'd be off the air, and that my station manager would be fired if I did it again. So I wrote to not the university president, he's been supportive, it's the vice president under him who controls the station. So I wrote to him and I asked him to define it for me so that I could follow the policies. I knew just what they were. And he told me they hadn't been defined yet, but that he and the ADL were working on that. So, hang on a second. Okay. Anyway, things went along. There's been a lot of stress and tension at the radio station. But nothing happened at WESU and at Wesleyan University. Nobody said a word. So and now in 2006, this past September, Christopher Bolin was scheduled to speak here by our 9/11 Truth Group. And I'm banned from talking about Israel. I can't have Kevin Barrett ever on my show and all of that. So I'm trying to work with that. I didn't mention Bolin on the air. I can't have him on. I couldn't interview him, but he was supposed to speak here. And I think the same group, I'm not sure, but they went to the Unitarian Church where we were having the event and put threatening remarks on their website, which they wouldn't tell me what they said, but they canceled the event. So I had to go on. They gave me a day's notice. So I went on the air, and I said that the event had been canceled because they were getting threats. And in my mind, when you want to censor something, then that's what you should actually be reading and want to know about, and I gave Bolin's websites. So then the ADL calls the university president again and says that I'm referring people to anti-Semitic websites and that my show should be off the air. So anyway, I produced the letter where I asked to them to define it, and they never did. So I said, I don't know what I'm supposed to say and not say on the air. So they told me that was strike two, and if I do anything again, if I do it again, I'll be off the air. So that's all happening there. So meanwhile, at Wesleyan University this past September, I think the ADL went there, and they can't get anywhere with the station manager because he really supports my show, and I'm told so to his boss in the administration of the university. But they have a student board that has full power of programming, and the student board is like 90% Jewish, and they decided that they want my show off the air, and they wrote me a letter this like 2 weeks ago saying that they were just going to change things up, and so they were going to cancel my show. Thanks for the years of service. And then I read from an internal email that someone sent me that they're saying that my show was promoting anti-Semitism, white supremacism, and xenophobes. And they mentioned Alex Jones, Jim Fetzer, and Bolin. And Fetzer was on my show once in the 9 years I've done a show, and it was his speech last year at the Left Forum, which was on the global war on terror, and he never mentioned anything about, they said he's a Holocaust denier. Well, I didn't recommend anyone go to his website and any of that. So And then they said Alex Jones was a known xenophobe, and I'm promoting that. Alex Jones was on my show for about 30 seconds introducing one of his speakers. It was his guest that I was, you know, airing on my show. So that's where we're at. My show has been off the air for 2 weeks. I have emailed them and asked to meet with the board, and they totally ignored me until I finally wrote them a long email debunking what they said. And they were going to put on the air a horrible statement about how I was promoting, you know, white supremacy, xenophobia, and anti-Semitism, and that's why they canceled it. And I told them if they did that, they would be speaking to my lawyer, and so they, as far as I know, they haven't done that. And ever since I wrote them this email, I wrote them a long email, and I forwarded it to everybody. And they have contacted me and said, oh, they weren't ignoring me, but I know they were because I saw their email saying they were just going to move on. So anyway, the station manager is trying to help me out on this. He can't get them to budge, and they're not meeting with me at the moment, although I'm going to insist again, but you know, they don't have to, I guess. So that's where we're at. And there's one other thing. At the University of Hartford, where I produce the show, often if I sign up for the production studio in advance, the machines when I get in don't work. They've been tampered with. And so the station manager has put a camera in there, and that has stopped it for a while, but now they've realized he never plugged the camera in, so it's starting to happen again. So that's where I'm at, and if anyone has any thoughts or advice on what I should do, I would really appreciate that.
Wow.
So it's pretty awful, and I'm seeing no one has a question, so we can just wrap it up then, or any comments? Oh, do I have everybody on? Let's see.
Cheryl?
Yes?
This is Lynn.
Oh, yeah, hi, Lynn.
Are your programs, is the archive safe?
The archives are at radioforall.net. And
they can't be removed, right?
Unless, you know, the ADL got to the people who run that and asked them to take them down, but
Do you have them anywhere else?
Well, I have hard copies.
Mm-hmm.
How about
CDs?
No Lies Radio?
It's on, I haven't done No, oh, yeah, it's aired there now, too, so the more recent ones are there, yeah.
Okay.
Is it still possible to get other radio stations to use those archives?
Sure. In fact, other people do. In fact, some people do, and I don't know it, but I know Boston College was airing them on Sunday mornings. I haven't checked recently, so I don't know if they still are, but they were the last time I checked.
So they go through Radio for All, not you, to get those?
Right, they go there and they download them, yeah. And so people take them that I don't even know about. And I know there's some radio station in Geneva, New York, that airs it because he emailed me and asked. But
well, I hope this isn't over, and we'll all do what we can. And thank you so much for all you've done. Gee.
Yeah, if people want to, you know, you can write a letter to them. I'll put an email out where you can send it to the board, and you know, you could just
thank
say something
you.
About
That's
that
a great
you'd like
idea.
The show reinstated or something. So, yeah, I'd appreciate anyone who can do that.
Good.
Yeah.
This is Barton. I want a quick comment.
Yes.
There's an event. This is the fourth year they've done it, and the title changes every year, but it's done at the National Press Club. It's an old event in the 13th floor ballroom, and some of them are pretty amazing who's there. I mean, the first year they had no less than four CIA people, including Phil Giraldi and Ray McGovern, and then they had people like Cynthia McKinney and everything else. But this year it's called the Israel Lobby and AmericanPolicy.org. And originally it had four 501c3, 501c4s, but the two that Allison Weir's, they lost money, but they sort of expected. But Allison Weir's two, the CNI Online, or Council for National Interest, online.org, and If Americans Knew dropped out for whatever reason, I think money. And so you're left with IRMEP, which is Grant Smith and the people, and WRMEA, which is Delinda Hanley and a whole lot of other people, all good people. And this one's March 24th. They had some promotions because I don't think they've sold all the seats they wanted to sell. Great event to go to, but of course you can get it all online, and there are former videos are online. C-SPAN covered it the first year, and then they dropped. They didn't do it the next year. They were under a lot of pressure probably not to do it, and then they got embarrassed into doing some of it. So who knows what will happen this year, but it's going to be online so you can watch it. But you might want to look at some of their old stuff. If you put in on your little Q&A card anything about 9/11, I guarantee you it won't be asked. I've tried. But it's an interesting thing to go to. And there may be some contacts and people if you really want to get into some of this. And there's a reception afterwards where you can rub elbows with everybody and chat any way you want. If anybody's going to be in Washington area, this is strategically located right near the annual Last Licking Contest, or APAC, or whatever it's called. And this year it's just a little bit before it, a few days. And so airline tickets are a little hard to get, and lodging's a little bit sticky, but you can find some. But it's a worthwhile thing to go to if you really want to meet other people who are concerned with the same people. Oh, this one does not address 9/11. That's all. I've said too much. But go look for it. Israel Lobby and AmericanPolicy.org for this year. But somewhere on there you'll find the other three preceding ones, which are Gideon Levy had two. One 2 years ago went viral. And there's all kinds of interesting comments by people who know what they're talking about. And it's a vast Israel lobby, and the control that it has is just outrageous.
No, thanks.
I wondered, is it too late to ask Cheryl a question? This is James.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
Well, I just wanted to, actually make a suggestion. Couldn't you consider requesting a kind of a student's town hall and ask them if they want to hear your programming and bring up your side of the whole story, and maybe somebody bring up the other side and leave it up to the students, if you can get such a thing, to decide the issue?
Well, I think actually the station manager had mentioned that he was considering something like that, so I think that's a good suggestion. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Check it out, yeah. And someone else had wanted to say something?
Yeah, this is Sheila. I just wanted to say I'm really sorry all that happened to you. That sounds really awful. And I wanted to point out about the term anti-Semitic. I think it's interesting that Jews are the only race, if that is a race, I'm not sure if that's what it is, but are the only race that have their own term for what's basically racism. I mean, if there's no term for being racist against any other group, and yet there's a specific term for what would be racism against Jews. And I just, I just wonder why that is.
Well, it's a stolen word. The Semites are the Palestinians, and except for a few Jews going way back to biblical times, the Khazarian mafia ones are very, very little Semitic, except for a little bit of accidental crossbreeding.
Okay.
It's a stolen, misused term.
We're a little bit over time here, so if there's no other questions on Cheryl's issue, Cheryl, is there a particular email address where people can send supportive letters?
Yeah, I'll send it out to the listserv, and then people can get it from there.
And also to Craig for the minutes, okay?
Okay, yeah.
I was just wondering if Cheryl had any comment to any reply to what I said. It wasn't directly a comment, but I was just curious if she had anything to say.
You know, I've had that same curiosity myself, and I sit here sometimes and I think, what would I, if they're anti-Catholic or something, there's no term, and I was, I don't know what to make of that, but I do think, I agree, it's curious, so.
I think we all should learn about the Global Anti-Semitism Review Act signed by President Bush in 2004.
Okay. Well,
this is Greg speaking.
It
gives 14 points.
Bill, if this is you, maybe we can discuss that next time when it's your turn to give us this overview. And we can
That
wasn't Bill.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt then. I thought that was Bill Wilt. Okay, go ahead.
No.
Greg, can you send us an email where we can share that with everybody?
Sure.
The link to it? Yeah, okay.
And you can find out why they're doing it. Point 14 is making any allegations of Mossad involvement in the 9/11 attack means you're anti-Semitic. That's just one out of the 14.
Wow.
So it's I'll send the 14 points of what is defined as anti-Semitism.
Good. What's the listserv
to the group?
Email address?
How do we get on the listserv?
Okay, yeah, the listserv is available to anybody who's been a participant in the teleconference. You simply email me your request to be on the listserv, and I'll put you on it, and then you'll get the instructions on how to send the messages there, okay? So,
okay,
if,
we'll do.
Okay, it's diogenesquest@gmail.com.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay, yeah, we can get you on pretty quickly. Just send me a request, okay? Anybody that wants to get on the listserv. Okay, so is that it then, Cheryl, for questions for you? Is anybody else on the stack? We'll go to our announcements. Does anybody have any announcements of any type that they'd like to share with the rest of us?
Well, Boston is not very far from Connecticut to Wesleyan, and so we could perhaps do a vigil or something like that for the radio program.
You mean come down to the university and do it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, indeed. My daughter is an alumna.
Okay. Well, that's a good point. Let's talk about that offline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's a good idea. Okay. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Okay. Any other announcements? All right, then. It sounds like we're finished for tonight. Thank you all for your participation and your cooperation. We'll look forward to seeing you again on the last Wednesday in March for another teleconference. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye, everyone.